this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Hannah LaChance about her past and present research involving Cisco and her future with the Knaus Marine Policy Fellowship. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Hannah LaChance. Hannah grew up as an Army brat, traveling to multiple states and countries such as Kansas, New York, Massachusetts, and Germany. She eventually made her way to Vermont, where she completed her undergraduate degree in animal science and wildlife biology. Having a wide interest in many areas of biology, Hannah has worked at zoos, aquariums, a conservation center for species survival, and many different research labs. All of Hannah's experiences helped uncover her passion for research and her desire to apply research to big-picture conservation and restoration efforts. So she went to graduate school at the University of Vermont, where she used various traditional and novel techniques to study Cisco and other Coregonines in the Great Lakes. While finishing her master's this past summer, Hannah worked for Vermont Fish and Wildlife before moving to New York 3 weeks ago to work at the USGS Lake Ontario Biological Station on more exciting Cisco research, and starting in February, Hannah will become a Knaus Marine Policy Fellow. Welcome to the podcast, Hannah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm excited it worked out.
Many people who work with fish have resumes and CVs filled with fishy experiences, but when I first read through your bio, I saw something that stood out a little bit. Instead of playing with fish during your undergraduate degree, you instead studied the microbiome in the rumen of impala. How did you become involved and interested in that particular area?
Good question. Yeah, my resume definitely hops around a little bit before I found fish, but I basically was an animal science major, which is more domesticated species, cattle, horses, et cetera. But I had started to discover that I like wildlife and conservation and just kind of more, you know, and to me, being an animal scientist, anything that's not domesticated is wild. So that's fish and terrestrial animals alike. So I actually had the opportunity to go to South Africa for a study abroad. And we were the first group of students from the University of Vermont to go on that particular study abroad. And while I was there, I met a professor. And when I got back to UVM, it turns out the professor I wanted to do research with was trying to collaborate with that professor in Africa. So I kind of stumbled into it, actually. I wanted to get some non-domestic experience, and it was going to be moose at the time, but this collaboration was beginning, and he saw that I had a little bit of lab experience and kind of gave me the project. So that's how I ended up studying the microbiome of impala from South Africa.
And after you finished your degree, you continued playing around with other ruminants, moose, dairy cattle, beef cattle, and you also worked with some fur bears, the bobcat and fisher. You mentioned you were originally going into animal science. Were you also more originally interested in working with mammals?
You know, my whole career has kind of been, I'm actively searching for what my passion is and what drives me, but also just a lack of experience in some ways. I came into college not really knowing what my options were, thought they were more broad, like biology or chemistry, or I actually started off in the College of Education because I was undecided and that's where they placed me. So through being an education major, they gave me a list of other majors because we needed to have a second major. And I looked down the list and I was like, animal science, that's a thing. And I kind of looked into it some more and it sounded really intriguing. I got a mix of different sciences because it's a lot of the prerequisites for vet school. So it's, you know, nutrition classes and biology and chemistry and organic chemistry and behavior. And it was just kind of a nice blend of all the different types of science I was interested in. And I got to work with animals, which I've always enjoyed, but just didn't realize I could make a career out of. So I kind of dove into that major and loved it. But when I got in the upper levels is when I started taking my extracurricular courses. And that's when I started diving into the more fish and wildlife side of things and realized I loved that, but didn't really feel like sticking around to switch my major. So I just made it a minor and tried to get experiences in research labs, et cetera, which is how I ended up in the area of undergraduate research that I did. So again, it was kind of just a little bit of a journey. Like it was a little bit of a proactive journey, but also kind of just stumbling into one thing after another. And I eventually found my way to the work that I'm doing now. And all the research experience after undergrad is a similar story. You know, the Moose microbiome, it was the same research lab that I did the Impala microbiome in. I was just helping a graduate student. And then I switched to a different professor's lab when she came in, and she was a new professor, so she had startup funds and was kind of willing to let me make a project of my own as her lab manager. And so I connected with Vermont Fish and Wildlife, and they connected me with the person in charge of their fur bearer projects. And he said, oh yeah, we've got all sorts of samples. We were basically just looking for ways to get our hands on free samples so we could start something. And so for 2 years straight, I went down when they would collect all the carcasses left over from the trapping season, and they'd get their data that they need, you know, length, weight, sex, et cetera. And then the carcasses were up for grabs to grab tissue samples for any kind of other research. And so we kind of started to investigate a couple of the different species that we collected there. And it was just, you know, again, a kind of a convenience thing, but also definitely intentional, just getting creative with our resources.
And a few of those projects that you just mentioned dealt with epigenetics. What exactly is epigenetics?
That is an excellent question. So epigenetics is basically, in genetics, you have ways that you can respond to the environment. And sometimes the environment causes a change to your DNA. It like mutates it, for example, into something else. But other times it changes how you use your DNA by preventing a certain gene from being read, for example. So it doesn't necessarily change the actual structure of the DNA, but it can change how the DNA is used. And so epigenetics is basically that kind of study of how environment affects the way that you use your genetic material. So one example of that is histone modifications. Basically, it just kind of, it can clamp itself onto the DNA while it's twisted up and prevent it from being untwisted. And if you can't untwist it, then you can't actually read the DNA into RNA, which then gets read into a protein and used. And so it just kind of prevents the use of certain genes by creating those modifications. And different environmental factors can lead to that, you know, so it's really interesting. It can be temperature, it could be light, it could be the kinds of food you eat, it could be the kind of air you breathe. It's a whole suite of things. So it's a fairly new study, but it's a big area of research for cancer research. And then it's becoming more popular for all sorts of other research, such as animal research and even wildlife and conservation and fisheries research.
And eventually you came to your senses and realized fish were the way to go with your career path, and you went back to school to study Cisco. Growing up in Iowa and now working in Kansas, I've never seen one or held one or worked with a Cisco. So could you describe a Cisco to someone like myself who has never seen one?
Yeah, so before graduate school, I had also never seen or heard of a Cisco, but I have definitely grown to love them. And so a Cisco is a prey fish that's native in the Great Lakes and a lot of other northern lakes. And they're silvery, but sometimes they're called greenbacks because when they're alive, sometimes you can see a little bit of a shimmery green on their back. So that was one of my favorite memories, actually, was looking at a Cisco swim away from a net, which is, you know, not great for research, but awesome to see a live Cisco in the lake. So they are a salmonid, so they actually have an adipose fin as well, which is a nice distinguishing characteristic. And Cisco is one form of coregonid or coregonines in the Great Lakes, which is basically just a suite of different forms of a similar fish. So I mostly studied Cisco, but I actually have branched into studying a bunch of different forms and how we can tell them apart, because it's very subtle. Sometimes it's just differences in body shape or mouth position, but they're all generally kind of silvery fish with an adipose fin that fulfill a similar ecological role, but also different ecological roles depending on where they are in the lake, if they're deep water or more pelagic, et cetera, et cetera. So I could go on and on, but I'll try to stop myself from getting ahead. But yeah, basically a silvery fish with an adipose fin. And I think they're cute because I'm biased.
Those that poke their heads into the fish Twitter universe on occasion may see the hashtag Cisco Inferno being used. What is that all about?
Yes. So luckily in the Cisco world, we have a number of wonderful Twitter users. And so in the past, I want to say 5 to 10 years, probably even less than 10 years, Cisco research has exploded. So my friend Ellen George, she is a recent graduate from Cornell. She just finished her PhD there, and her Twitter handle is Great Lakes Cisco. So she is one of the few people who kind of got this push of Cisco Twitter experiences going. And one of the experiences is around spawning time. There's a bunch of different research going across the Great Lakes for setting nets and trying to capture the adults as they're coming into spawn. And so to try to get a hold of all the different research that's going on and all the different sampling, she created, I believe it was her who created the hashtag Cisco Inferno. And so now we have Cisco Inferno 18 and Cisco Inferno 19 for the different years. So it's been kind of fun to be able to keep track of all the cool Cisco stuff that's going on by following that hashtag. And we've come up with so many other puns since then. We're a very ridiculous group who enjoys puns. But it's been a fun group to be part of because I studied Cisco in the Great Lakes, but I was in Vermont. So it was nice to be part of that community through Twitter. And it made me feel like I was part of the group that was, you know, consistently in the Great Lakes. Now I'm in the Great Lakes, but in Vermont, I felt a little distant, but Twitter helped connect me.
And you've dropped a little bit of hints and pieces, more descriptors about the Cisco, but why don't you tell us a little bit about the Cisco life history? Do they spawn in the spring or fall or?
Sure. So Cisco are a late fall, early winter spawner. So it depends on the lake, but generally they come in sometime mid to late November, early December, and they try to time, you know, it seems like they're timing their spawning with when ice out is about or ice on is about to happen, and their eggs develop under ice all throughout the winter, and they time their hatch usually with about when the ice comes off the lake. And so generally people have found spawning sites in areas that you expect ice, but that's just some foreshadowing into research that I did and others have done looking at, you know, what could be leading to success of Cisco spawning. Is it ice? Is it in different environmental factors? Is it habitat? Is it depth? There's a lot of questions. And kind of taking a step back real quick, the reason we're asking these questions, besides, you know, just wanting to know more about Cisco because they're cool, we obviously have a bigger purpose, which is, as I said, Cisco are a native fish to the Great Lakes, and they're a big prey resource. So throughout their entire life cycle, they feed a bunch of different predators. So their eggs are consumed in the winter and have been shown to be an important winter subsidy that fish can rely on not only in the winter, but throughout the rest of the year. And then when they hatch as larvae, they're consumed by a bunch of different fish as well. And as they grow throughout their entire life, they're providing this native, healthy food source. Some invasives have come in and filled that void a little bit, but there's some concern that it might be, you know, perhaps not the healthiest food source. So, for example, there's some research into thiamine deficiencies. And I don't know as much about that, so I won't talk for too long about that. But basically, alewife are thought to lead to an issue with thiamine in lake trout eggs, I believe. And so they do not see that problem when they eat Cisco, which is a native source. So that's just one of many reasons. Cisco are also an important economic resource in the Great Lakes. They provide, you know, a local fish that you can see at restaurants. And also, interestingly enough, their eggs have become a popular source for caviar in Northern Europe. And so there's an interest in harvesting them for that purpose as well. So basically, there's a lot of reasons to kind of keep an eye on Cisco and try to ensure that they are successful in the Great Lakes. But there was also their populations are nowhere near where they used to be due to over-harvesting back in the, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. And so while some populations have rebounded, like in Lake Superior, they're still not where they used to be. And we're a little concerned that the small populations, plus the idea that their recruitment is super variable. They have some good recruitment years and some bad recruitment years. And we haven't seen a good recruitment year in a long time. So we need to see one soon if we want these populations to keep doing well, which is why we're kind of zooming in on this critical phase of egg and larval research, or at least that's where my research comes in, because that early life history is where we think the recruitment issues could be occurring.
You kind of gave some hints at the beginning of your answer, and then you looped back around to provide a nice segue. For your master's degree, you studied how environmental characteristics such as reduced light could affect Cisco eggs developing over winter. How do those characteristics affect the eggs?
Right. So kind of like we've hinted at a bunch of different times through this conversation so far, the environment has been something that I've been interested in and its effect on organisms. And so when I came onto this project, one of the appealing aspects was that we were looking at how differences in changes due to, you know, whether we want to call it climate change or not, the fact is that we're seeing less ice in the Great Lakes and changes in temperature, et cetera, et cetera. And while the changes in temperature have been studied, so changes in water temperature speed up development in these eggs, there are other factors linked to differences in winter that are currently happening and projected to continue to happen that we wanted to investigate. And so one of the big factors that I've hinted at earlier is ice. Cisco, you know, spawn right before ice comes on and they hatch right when ice melts off. And so we think that seems to be some sort of an important cue. And while temperature might be that cue, we think it might be more of a suite of characteristics. So when you look at ice, you can think, okay, well, if there's no ice, which is what's happening and projected to continue to happen, what else changes? Well, temperature changes, flow can change, but also the amount of light that reaches the eggs can change. So when there's ice, and then even when there's snow on top of that ice, it can really reduce the amount of light that can penetrate into the water column, into the depths where Cisco eggs are. So with lack of ice, that means more light is getting through. And light has been shown to be a cue in a lot of different organisms, such as birds. And I don't know if people have heard of circadian rhythm before, but generally light is a cue that can trigger a bunch of different pathways. And so we were curious to see if light is possibly something to keep an eye on or something that could be affecting the speed of development and downstream success of the eggs. So we did kind of a pilot study where we took some eggs from Lake Ontario and reared them under 24-hour light, a regular photo period, so the sunset, sunrise cycle that mimics where they were pulled out of in Lake Ontario, and then also a 24-hour dark treatment. And we wanted to use these extreme light and dark situations because there wasn't a lot of pre-existing research, so we didn't know if light was going to have an effect at all. And once we knew if there was an effect, then we could start getting at, you know, if it's different intensities and how that affects them. So anyways, we started with this kind of large scale, light or dark. They were raised in constant light or constant dark, and how did that affect them? And again, it was a pilot study, so there's limited conclusions we can draw from this, but we did see differences in hatch time, and then we also saw differences in survival because of limited replicates. Again, I'm like just kind of, you know, being careful about like how excited and how much we can jump forward with these conclusions, but there definitely were some differences. And so kind of where I came in with my genetics experience was I added another component to this project. So instead of just, you know, counting the number of those that survived or didn't survive, or, you know, assessing development visually through the eggs, since the eggs are clear, I also was doing genetics. And instead of using epigenetics, which we talked about earlier, I used transcriptomics, which I did not know what it was before I started grad school, because it's a very specific, you know, area of genetics. Basically, when you have a gene that you're using, you need to convert that into a protein. And kind of the intermediate step is RNA. So, you know, the gene gets read into RNA and their RNA gets translated into
So it's, you know, transcribed and then translated into a protein. And so if we capture that RNA, we can focus on just the genes that we're actually using, because you're never using all of your genes at once. So we wanted to figure out which genes are being used and at what level. And are the genes that are being used in the light treatment different than the dark treatment? And so basically we compared that, and we did find that there are some different genes being used in the treatments, and that the genes that are being used in the light treatment, there were genes being turned on that are related to metabolism that weren't being used in the dark treatment. So basically they were kind of triggering pathways that caused them to burn through more of their energy reserves than the dark treatment eggs. And so that is just kind of an interesting extra component that we were able to add by using this molecular method. So basically further research would need to be done, but that's just kind of one of the cool things that we were able to tell is, you know, environmental factors do matter and we need to focus on more than one, and light something to keep our eye on to continue to study in the future.
And you mentioned in your answer that you got to play around with some of your genetic background for that project. You also got to fall back on some genetic experience for another project when you studied some larval Coregonan populations in Lake Superior. What can you tell us about that project?
So that was a really cool project where we had the opportunity to assess a larval population from the time that they hatched out until they disappeared into the juvenile stage when they were when we weren't catching them at, with the nets that we used to capture the larval population. And so basically what we did was we were sampling the Coregona population in the Apostle Islands of Lake Superior. And we had 10 different sites in the Apostle Islands, and we would sample them once a week. And what we kind of went into the project thinking is, number one, nobody's really been able to intensively sample one area of larval Coregonids yet in the Great Lakes. It's more of an annual survey where they sample multiple sites once throughout the year. And while that's very informative, like knowing more about that one life stage throughout the life stage would be very helpful. And so we were going to assess, you know, how big they are when we're capturing them, how quickly they grow. Another coworker of mine, Verena, she was working on the stomach contents of these larvae to figure out what they're eating. I do not envy her having to dissect all the stomachs and identify their contents, but she handled that part of the project. And then kind of bringing in my genetics experience again, we decided to use a method called genomics and RAD sequencing. And so basically in some of my past research, and just because of how rapidly genetics is evolving, we only were able to focus on small parts of the genome at a time. And now with differences in sequencing technology and sequencing technology getting a little cheaper, we can look at larger portions of the genome. And so RAD sequencing, we were able to look at not the whole genome, but large portions of it. And so while people have looked at the genetics of Disco and other Coregonids before and tried to tell how genetically similar they are to one another, they were only looking at a small portion of the genome to do that. And if you do it just right, that's still pretty effective, but looking at the whole genome gives us just a better picture of if there are any differences, because obviously you're just looking at more of the genome, so it just increases your chances of finding differences. So anyways, we kind of went in there thinking, all right, so we feel pretty confident that most of the larvae in the Apostle Islands are probably Cisco, and we want to figure out how genetically related they are to one another. Is it parents spawning off of different islands, or are they all just kind of spawning everywhere in the Apostle Islands? And does that, are different genetic couples, you know, a mom and a dad producing offspring that are better fit? And so that's kind of the questions and thoughts we went into this with, which was going to be very valuable. But we actually ended up finding something even cooler. So while we thought it was mostly Cisco in the Apostle Islands, we actually found three different forms of Coregonids. So we found Cisco, which is Coregonus artidae, which is kind of a pelagic, more popular species. And then we found two deep water forms of Coregonids, Kaii and Hoyai, or bloater is what some people call them. And so it was really interesting because, number one, we weren't sure if we'd be able to differentiate these different forms of coregonins, and we found out that we can. And number two, now that we can tell them apart, we were able to tell differences in their life history that we weren't able to tell before. So normally we, you know, we've been able to rear bloater and cisco in hatchery settings, but that doesn't quite replicate what you expect to find in the natural setting. So we were able to tell that they emerge at different times. So cisco emerged first, and then kai-eye, and then bloater. So they have temporal differences in when they hatch or come to the surface where we were sampling them. And then also how they were using their yolk sac seems to change, and how quickly they grow has slight differences. So basically it just kind of opened the world of possibilities for studying these species, because as I mentioned before, they look pretty similar as adults, but as larvae, they look almost identical. And so we haven't been able to tell them apart before. So now we are able to tell them apart using genetics, and it just was really exciting to be there as this was happening and kind of be part of that exciting find.
And the Cisco celebration doesn't end there. You recently started a new job at the USGS, also researching Cisco. And will you be doing more of the same work, or are you able to look at something a little different?
That's a great question. Yes. So I am very excited that I get to continue studying Cisco. Through Twitter and through conferences and through just kind of sharing results with people and collaborating, I have worked with some of the folks at USGS in Lake Ontario before I came here. And so when they had a project pop up that was to study Cisco eggs, I was very excited and jumped on that opportunity right away. So instead of rearing eggs in a hatchery or studying larvae as they hatch, I'm now studying eggs in a wild setting. And so there's been some previous work done by students such as Ellen George and Matt Pavey from Cornell and others throughout the Great Lakes that have set some different mats or traps to capture the eggs. It's basically you set them on the bottom of the lake before the fish come. The fish come and lay their eggs, and the eggs settle on these traps, and then you can pull them up and, number one, tell if there's eggs there, and number two, try to tell which eggs they are or the quality of the eggs, et cetera, the abundance of the eggs. So they were doing this mostly to try to find spawning sites in Lake Ontario. They have ideas of where historic spawning sites were, but they want to know where Cisco are currently using for spawning. And so they've found, you know, Chemeau Bay is a known spawning site for Cisco. But we're, you know, trying to answer other questions now, such as, are they spawning at different depths? Is habitat more of a factor? Do they like only rock or sand or a mix of habitats? Just trying to kind of add some clarity to previous research that has looked at that. And so I'm here to kind of be part of that push to sample more locations and answer more of these questions a little more thoroughly. So I'm excited to get out there and continue doing some field work, which I enjoy, and also use some of my Cisco knowledge, which I'm excited to continue. So I'm pretty happy with this opportunity, but I got to cram it all into 5 months before I move to DC. So that's going to be a little tight, but I am going to, you know, do the best I can to squeeze some solid field work and data out of my time here.
I'm sure you've had plenty of field work experience so far on the job, and you had to even reschedule recording this podcast because you had to get called away on a research cruise. Was this for Cisco stuff, or was this a different project?
That was actually just a different project. So even though my predominant goal here is Cisco, and I'll be out on, ironically enough, a boat called the Whitefish, which is kind of a cousin of the Cisco or a relative of the Cisco. We have a larger research vessel, the RV Cahoe, and they had the opportunity for me to come help finish up their adult lake trout survey. And so I went out and helped them kind of, you know, pick fish and assess fish from that, which was great because even though I've worked with Vermont Fish and Wildlife and other researchers on Lake Champlain with a lake trout, you know, everything's a little bit bigger in the Great Lakes. So it was really cool to see Great Lakes fish at that scale.
And you also hinted that in 5 months you'll be moving to Washington, D.C. for the Knaus Marine Policy Fellowship. I've had past Knaus fellows on the podcast, Katie O'Reilly, another Great Lakes researcher, but it's been a while, so why don't you refresh our listeners on what this program is and what exactly you'll be doing?
Sure. So basically, even though it's called a Marine Policy Fellowship, it's kind of expanded over the years. And so basically, it's a fellowship through Sea Grant, which is through NOAA, and it has become an opportunity for fellows such as myself to go to DC and be placed with either a legislative or an executive office. And I've branched executive, which was my preferred choice. And so basically we'll be placed within a specific office, which I don't know yet. I'm going to find out in October which office. But it's an excellent opportunity to just kind of learn how policy works, like how is policy made, how is policy implemented, and more specifically policy around ocean and coastal and Great Lakes resources. And I actually didn't know too much about it. Our Sea Grant program in Vermont is pretty new. But I, again, through Twitter, had actually seen that Katie O'Reilly was finishing up her fellowship at the time that I was applying. And so I actually reached out to her over Twitter, never knowing her, and just kind of asked, hey, what's this fellowship about? And she was super sweet and helpful. And so I was like, this sounds great. I'm going to apply. And I was lucky enough to be named a finalist. And so I am excited to go to DC and learn as much as I can and kind of see where that takes me. I really enjoy the research, but to me, I want to make sure that the bigger picture is still my goal. And I want to use research to actually be put towards conservation and restoration. So I think this will be a great opportunity to learn how that works and how policy can help with that and how research can help policy and just kind of how everything is connected. So yeah, I hope it all is all that it lives up to be. I've heard only good things about this fellowship, so I'm excited.
Well, Hannah, thank you for filling us all in on Cisco, but now the tough part of the interview is over as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
You know, it's funny, these questions are sometimes harder than me rambling about my research, but this one's easy because it's going to be a Cisco, duh. I am fairly new to fisheries compared to some people who have spent their whole careers in fisheries, but the research that I've done so far with Cisco has just been so exciting. There's just so much going on. People call them the Darwin's finches of the Great Lakes because there's just so much variety within the Coregonids. But Cisco is kind of where I started, so they hold a special place in my heart, and they're my favorite.
What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Okay, so this is tricky because as we talked about earlier, my career's kind of been a little all over the place, and I've had a lot of wonderful opportunities. But I'll stick with a fish one for this. So I think for me, going to the Apostle Islands to help sample was incredible. It's just so beautiful up there. And it was one of the earlier fieldwork experiences for me because a lot of my previous work was lab work, and I had wanted grad school to open the door to more fieldwork. And that was just kind of all my hopes and dreams of grad school coming together into a cool project and a cool place and actually doing the type of research and the using methodology that I had always dreamed of. So it was a great time going there and sampling.
All right. And what is your dream job or dream location?
That is tricky. I really enjoy the kind of stuff I've been doing, working in the Great Lakes with a bunch of different organizations and agencies. I love how collaborative everyone generally is. So I kind of like the community there. But I also don't know what kind of opportunities the Knaus is going to open up for me. So it's hard to say until I know what doors will be open for me in the future. But kind of broadly, I just want to be working somewhere where I can do a mix of the things I love. I can, you know, maybe use some of my lab skills there, but definitely use some field skills. And I want to have a seat at the table where I get to have my voice heard in these conservation and restoration kind of community efforts. So not really a specific job or location, but definitely somewhere where I can have a similar experience to that I've already been getting in the Great Lakes, because I've really enjoyed my time researching out here.
All right, if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Oh, so many ideas. The more you spend researching, the more you come up with questions. I guess I really like kind of the direction we've been going with some of the Cisco research. You know, if I were to jump off the Apostle Islands project with the larvae, now that we have the ability to tell these forms apart, I kind of have this urge to go all throughout the Great Lakes and identify all the larvae and find where they are. And then we can figure out, if we can find them at the larval stage, then that narrows down where they're spawning. And that also just kind of gives us more of an idea of what habitat's important to that form. And it just helps open up a lot of closed doors that would be useful. So if I had all the money and time and effort, I would probably sample the Great Lakes and identify the rest of the Kerguelenian forms at the larval stage. But, you know, it kind of opens up the door to all stages.
And finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
So many. I think I'm going to have to go with kind of a basic kindergarten principle. Sharing is caring. Some of the research labs that I've worked in the past, while all the people have been wonderful, some of the larger communities have been a little bit more competitive instead of collaborative. And it just makes it hard to move forward with answering questions. So if you're keeping your research on the down low until you publish it because you don't want anyone to steal it or know about it, it makes it hard to plan your research collaboratively and kind of answer a broader question using all the different people and their experiences at the study system's disposal. And so basically, I've mentioned it before, that's what I've enjoyed about my time researching in the Great Lakes, is my experience has been that people are generally thinking about big picture and they work together to answer the bigger questions and realize where their agency or organization or skills can come in to help. And so kind of sharing your skills versus trying to keep it to yourself and only think about, you know, what you think you can do. Just kind of opening it up, sharing is caring. So a little cheesy, but I think that just kind of covers a lot of what I've seen. And I think sharing just helps in a lot of ways. So,
well, Hannah, thank you again for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your past and current projects with Cisco and your future in DC with the Canals Fellowship. If people want to find out more information and get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
They can definitely find me on Twitter. I think my handle is Hannah M. LaChance, so first, middle initial, and last name. I could also be reached over email. It's lachance.hannah, so LACHANCE dot Hannah, HANNAH, at gmail.com. And I'm happy to chat with anyone about any of the stuff that I've done. I love talking about my experiences. So,
and if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive the remaining episode on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 56th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, sharing is caring.